Daniel chapter 2 is going to be our text this morning, and our text is the first 24 verses, but I'm going to go ahead and read the first 36 verses, so it reminds you of everything that's going on in this chapter. Daniel chapter 2, starting at verse 1, says, "In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac or Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, The thing is gone from me, if you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof. You shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They answered again and said, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. The king answered and said, I know of a certainty that you would gain time because you see the thing is gone from me. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requires. And there is none that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, Why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. And Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the season. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might, and has made known unto me now what we desire of thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. Therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, Destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. And Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. And the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king? But there is a God in heaven that reveals secrets and makes known unto King Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter? And he that reveals secrets makes known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known unto the king, make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, and his breast and arms of silver, his belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and broke them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away. And there was no place found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. We'll stop there. That's actually much more than we'll be covering in our message today. And in modern storytelling, especially in screenwriting for movies, there's this well-known plot device called a MacGuffin. A MacGuffin is something that serves to move the story forward, to sort of push it to its ultimate climax, but it only briefly becomes the focal point of the narrative. If you'll excuse me for using some movie examples, I know how sanctified it is to use movies as a sermon illustration. A MacGuffin can be things like the plan for a Death Star that's in R2-D2 in Star Wars, or the Ring of Power in The Lord of the Rings, or even a sled named Rosebud if you're a fan of Citizen Kane and more classic movies like that. The point being that there's something that moves the story forward, but it really shouldn't become the entire focal point of the narrative. Well, this account in Daniel chapter 2, while it is a 100% true and authentic and accurate, I think we have something similar happening here. King Nebuchadnezzar has this disturbing dream. He has a nightmare vision of a statue that is apparently in human form, and the description finally comes in verses 32 and 33, that it has a head that's of gold, and a chest and arms of silver, and abs of and thighs of bronze, and legs of iron, and on with the description. And the mighty king of Babylon woke up when his royal PJs, drenched in sweat, Nebuchadnezzar's nightmare, this sort of metallic monstrosity, held his attention. And it certainly grabs our attention as well. If you remember Daniel chapter 2, any well-read Christian who knows this chapter, when we mention Daniel 2, you're probably going to start envisioning this statue or this image and whatever charts and graphs and pictures that you've seen to illustrate it. But there is a bigger story going on here. We're not even going to get to that statue itself today. We're not going to deal with the dream and the meaning of the dream. Because listen, if Daniel gives us 30 verses before even hinting at the existence of this dreamy statue, much less giving us a description of it, it might just be that there is a bigger story that is unfolding here. And that statue, while it is fascinating, it is meant to be part of this bigger story that's happening. I'm convinced that's the case here in Daniel. I want you to think about how the book of Daniel is recorded for us and what it contains. It's not just an anthology of a collection of stories that we tell our kids in Sunday school. Daniel is telling one story. He has one big theme that he's trying to get through to us. If you remember a couple of weeks ago in the introduction to Daniel, there was a little note on the bottom of your handout that said that Daniel chapter 2 through 7 were actually not written in Hebrew. They're written in Aramaic, the language of Babylon. You can actually see where that starts. Right there in verse 4, it says that they spoke the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac. That's where the Aramaic section starts. And from chapter 2 all the way through chapter 7, it's all in Aramaic, the language of Babylon. Now, if that's not sufficient to convince you that there's a bigger story being told, then consider what you know about this Aramaic section. Daniel chapter 2 through 7, you know what's there. It's hard to put it into words, so I since it's easier to visualize, I tried to give you a chart on the first page of your handout this morning. What's happening there in chapter 2 is you have Nebuchadnezzar's dream of his statue, and then in chapter 3 you have the story of the Hebrew boys in the fiery furnace. And then in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, goes insane. In chapter 5, a different king named Belshazzar sees the handwriting on the wall, and his judgment comes. In chapter 6, you have Daniel and the lion's den. And then in chapter 7, you've got Daniel's own dream of four different creatures. But if you see the way that develops, there's a theme there. In chapter 2 and in chapter 7, you've got this dream that's representing four kingdoms. In chapter 3 and chapter 6, you've got this threat of false worship. In chapter 4 and 5, you have two different stories of a king who is humbled before God. There is this bigger story going on. God has a plan for history, and his plan, he's going to inaugurate a righteous kingdom to the glory of his son. And you are going to be called on. You are going to be tempted and threatened to join in with the world and its human-centered, man-glorifying worship. But if you stay faithful to Jesus, because he is with you, he's with you in your life. He might be with you in a lion's den. He might be with you in a fiery furnace. One day, all the kingdoms of this world and all the kings of this world are going to be humbled before him. I want to make sure you understand this. Daniel 2 is not telling us a story about a wicked king or his helpless servants or even that metallic monstrosity that filled his dreams. This is a part of the developing story of King Jesus. So as we walk through these first 24 verses together, when we don't get to that statue and the dream and the meaning of the dream, I want you to know you're not missing anything there. Lord willing, we'll talk about that statue next week, but I promise it is not the best part of this chapter. As Daniel sort of weaves this narrative, he moves forward to the disclosure of that vision. We'll see a royal nightmare in verses 1 through 12, a reliable resource in verses 13 through 18, and a reason for praise in verses 19 through 24. The royal nightmare in verses 1 through 12, we find out right away in verse 1, by the way, that Daniel is not necessarily telling his story in strict chronological order. Right? That chart I gave you gives you a hint that he's got a different order he's trying to give us. Verse 1, historically we know that when Nebuchadnezzar sacked Jerusalem, he ended up leaving Judah and going back to Babylon when he got news that his father had died. And that makes Nebuchadnezzar's first year of king the year that Jerusalem was under siege and Daniel was taken captive. But we know from chapter 1, how many years is Daniel in that Babylonian training? Right? He's put into that Babylonian training program for 3 years. But verse 2 tells us this story happens in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar the king. So my best understanding of the order of events here is that Daniel 2 happened about 2 years into that 3 years of training that Daniel and his friends went through. Verse 2 tells us this story happened in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar. Actually, verse 1 tells us that, right? Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, they're all students, essentially learning the language and history and literature and practices of Babylon. Now, there's other possibilities, but I think that makes the most sense of it. And this especially makes sense of why Daniel was set apart. Back in chapter 1, verse 17, it says all four of them were given knowledge and skill and learning and wisdom from God, but Daniel specifically understood visions and dreams. And that ability, that special, funny, wise men, his soothsayers, his conjurers. And he tells them in verse 3, I've had a dream and I want to know what it means. And their reaction is predictable, right? Then spoke in verse 4, then spoke the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever, much like people say nowadays, long live the king. O king, live forever. The problem is Nebuchadnezzar's dream makes him pretty certain that that's not going to happen. O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we'll show you the interpretation. Because look, we're good at this. This is what we train for. It's part of our job description. They had textbooks in order to interpret dreams. Archaeologists have actually dug some of those manuals up and found them. Sometimes they even did weird things in the process, putting on a show. They would take an animal and kill it and cut it open and say, well, let's look at the shape of its liver, and that tells us that it means this. But the problem is they're like a lot of con men. They can put on a good show, but when it actually comes to be subjected to testing, they can't hold up. If Nebuchadnezzar tells them his dream, they'll make up an answer, and who's to say whether they're right or wrong? I think this is another misconception we have about Daniel 2. We think that Nebuchadnezzar does not remember his dream. And while that is a possible interpretation, I think it is unlikely that that's the case. We usually think that he doesn't remember because of the way a phrase in verses 5 and verses 8 is translated. The phrase, the thing is gone from me. But that phrase probably means something more like the word has gone out from me. Or in other words, what he's saying is my decision is firm, my word is final. I mean, think about this. He's dreamed this dream several times. It's very disturbing to him. He knows what the dream is. He just doesn't know what it means. And Nebuchadnezzar is nobody's fool. Somewhere along the line, he has developed a distrust of his mystical-minded advisors. He knows if he says, well, here's what I dreamed, that they'll say, well, here's what it means. And there's no way to test to see whether or not they're right. So he develops a test by saying, my decision is firm. I've made up my mind. You tell me what the dream was, and then tell me what the dream means. That's what that phrase there means. My decision is final. Look at how it works in verses 5 through 8. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me, or the word has gone out from me. My decision is final. If you will not make known unto me the dream and the interpretation, you'll be cut to pieces. Your houses be made a dunghill. But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They answered again and said, note here in verse 7, apparently the wise men think that Nebuchadnezzar remembers his dream. they answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we'll show you the interpretation of it. And the king said, I know of a certainty that you would gain time because you see my decision is final. The thing has gone out from me. This isn't really a bad ploy on Nebuchadnezzar's part, although the penalty phase of his plan is a little bit harsh. His advisors are sure that Nebuchadnezzar knows what the dream was, and so they ask him again, just tell us what it means, and he refuses to do it. So now they have two choices. They can either tell the king what he dreamed and what it meant, and thereby receive gifts and treasure and honor and fame, or they can fail to tell Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamed and what it meant, and end up dismembered and have their homes turned into a trash dump or a public outhouse. That punishment might seem extreme, but it is certainly not unparalleled in the history of Babylon in general and Nebuchadnezzar in particular. The only real question they would have had isn't, well, is he serious about this? It would be, when he says he's going to have us in pieces, are we going to be cut apart with a sword, or are we going to get pulled apart by horses? So they're saying in verse 4, just tell us the dream. And even after hearing the command, they say in verse 7, okay, just tell us the dream. But he won't do it. There's the key to the end of verse 8 saying, I know you are just stalling. You're just stalling, but my decision is final. And from there it gets more heated. Look at verses 9 through 11. If you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. There is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such a thing of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requires, and there is none that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Now I want you to just stop for a second and ask yourself, why are we reading this? Why does Daniel want us to hear these words of mutual tell-off session between the king and his advisors? And I think the answer is that everything that's happened to this point is a confession about the uselessness of paganism and human wisdom. Look, Nebuchadnezzar's power and wisdom, it cannot bring him peace. The man can't sleep at night. And the pagan astrologers and magicians and the religious gurus like mediums and fortune tellers and astrologers today, they can perform a good show, but when it really comes to put up or shut up time, they've got nothing. They're fortune tellers and occult leaders and astrologers and spiritists and enchanters and mediums who supposedly talk to the dead, but listen, then and now, they cannot offer you any real answers. In their anger with Nebuchadnezzar, they admit as much. For all their wicked pretenses, they get these words right in verses 10 and 11. There is not a man on earth that could do what you're asking. And because everybody knows that, there's never been a king or a lord or a ruler who has been so arrogant as to ask these things. And in verse 11, they say the only hope Nebuchadnezzar has isn't going to come in any way except through divine wisdom. The gods, they say. But their dwelling is not with flesh. In other words, you're asking for something that only supernatural, a divine being could know, but we don't have any of them here. They're not talking to us. Oh, but there is a God in Babylon. He's the God of all creation. This story is just setting the stage for him to work. Their defense is to admit that they are as powerless as the rest of humanity. And they also use some harsh words for the king. They essentially call Nebuchadnezzar an unreasonable, illogical royal fruitcake, which is a big mistake on their part. He wasn't bluffing. Verse 12, for this cause, right, because of their arrogant response, the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. You can almost hear the king losing his temper and shouting, listen, kill them all. And unfortunately, as that decree goes out, it's going to include more than just the wise men there in his throne room. Those nattering knuckleheads in his throne room are going to be subject to his kill them all order. But it's also going to include bureaucrats and their faraway posts. And it's going to apparently include four Hebrew boys who are still learning the wise man trade. And those boys are about to get an education in Babylonian injustice. In verses 13 through 18, we see, though, they have a reliable resource. It is hard to say where Daniel and his friends were when Arioch showed up. But they knew what he was there for. Look at verse 14. Arioch, he's out there rounding up the wise men. He is called the captain of the king's guard. That term in Aramaic is taba, and it actually means executioner. It says in verse 24 that he was assigned to destroy the wise men of Babylon. This is the king's special executioner. And so Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, they're doing their Babylonian studies, and they're suddenly surrounded by the king's henchmen and the chief executioner. Now, obviously, the order was not to kill all the wise men immediately. Apparently, they're being rounded up, probably in order to have a public execution, to put on a show. Nebuchadnezzar wants to watch. And it's also going to be a fair warning to anybody else who seeks to be his advisor by claiming to have some mystical abilities that they don't really have. But I want you to make note of Daniel's reaction, the difference between Daniel's reaction compared to the other wise men. We saw that they had insulted the king and reacted with indignation, and yet Daniel's reaction, look at verse 14, the Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom. Those are words meaning prudence, wisdom, discretion, tact, judgment, taste, discernment. Look, there's a principle for God's people here. If you are going to be useful in a time of crisis, you need to have more composure than the world around you has got. If you are just flying off the handle with anger, or you're prone to throwing emotional fits about the unfairness of it all, before you seek spiritual wisdom, you're acting like the world acts, not influencing the world for good. Amazingly, as he's being arrested by the king's executioner, Daniel responds with composure, wisdom, tact. From Arioch's perspective, Daniel was probably the first calm, even-minded person he had encountered that day. You know, the king is shouting, slaughter them all. The wise men are screaming and protesting as they're being dragged away. Daniel just looks at Arioch and calmly says, hey man, what's the hurry? Verse 15, he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. Well, we can't give Daniel all the credit there. Just like God had given him favor with the chief of the eunuchs in chapter 1. God has given him favor with Arioch, and maybe that's because Arioch understands what the king really wants. The king really wants to know what his dream meant. And if Daniel can do that, it's a chance for Arioch's own advancement. In verse 25, as he brings Daniel before the king, he's actually going to look at Nebuchadnezzar and say, hey, I have found the guy who can tell you the interpretation of your dream. He's going to take credit. But Daniel acted with composure. He also acted with courage. Arioch tells him the story, and Daniel's reaction is, okay, take me to the king. Y'all, I gotta tell you, when Nebuchadnezzar, a king of Babylon, is in a mindless rage, the last thing I would do is ask to be taken to the throne room. But Daniel's got guts, especially since Nebuchadnezzar had just been livid with the wise men, telling the wise men, I'm sick of it, you're just stalling for time. But what Daniel does is he asks for more time. In verse 16, Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. There's the big difference, though. All the wise guys were asking for time in order to stall because they couldn't do what the king had asked. Daniel is asking for time so that he can do what the king has asked. That is massively different. But look at how he goes about doing it. Daniel doesn't take this time so that he can go back to his dorm room and open up his textbooks about the occult so that he can start interpreting dreams. You can see in verse 17, he returns to his friends and says, look, fellas, it's time for a prayer meeting. He acted with composure. He acted with courage. He also acts with confidence. He is confident in God's ability to make this dream and its meaning known. Keep in mind here, Daniel and his friends are young men. They're almost certainly teenagers. If they were 14 or 15 in chapter 1, then they're 16, 17 now. Daniel is not the bearded old man that you're usually picturing. He's more likely an awkward teenage boy with acne and scraggly facial hair. But these boys have the wisdom to be united in prayer. They're seeking the Lord's face. They're unashamed of their commitment to the Lord God of heaven. Look at verse 18. It says that they would desire the mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men. Look, they didn't seek justice from God. Verse 18 says they desired mercies from the God of heaven. Only a fool demands the justice of God. They ask for mercy. And in verse 18, it sounds like it's just mercy for themselves, but that's not the case. When we get to verse 24, you're going to see Daniel request a stay of execution for all of the wise men. Look, it's very likely that Daniel knows these men are in some ways victims of their own sin. They're trapped in Satan's clutches. They're enslaved to this idolatry. And he also knows these wise men, their public execution, even if it is painfully getting ripped apart by horses, that would not be the worst part of their day. Because that would merely be ushering them into a fiery torment in hell for eternity. And so Daniel has some compassion on them. Like I said last week, he's ultimately going to have the kind of influence on them that later results in some wise men from this area coming to worship King Jesus when he is born. Daniel tells Arioch, don't kill the wise men, just take me to the king. So we've seen a royal nightmare and a reliable resource. Verses 19 through 24 shows us a reason for praise. I want you to think back, if you can, to what it was like to read Daniel chapter 2 for the first time. Hopefully you're all familiar with it, but some of you might be hearing it for the first time today. When you get to verse 19, it simply says, the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And so now ask yourself, as you're hearing this story for the first time, who knows the dream and the interpretation of the dream? Well, Nebuchadnezzar knows the dream. Daniel knows the dream, and he knows the meaning of the dream. But you know who's clueless? Well, yeah, it's true that the wise men are clueless, but you know who else is clueless? You are. You don't know what this is about. You realize through this whole chapter, as Daniel's writing the story, Daniel is not, and he will not allow this dream and the meaning of the dream to become the primary focus. At this point, he is still holding it back from us. Again, the dream and its meaning, while it is fascinating and important, Lord willing, we'll deal with it next week. The dream and its meaning is not the focal point of Daniel chapter 2. It's all been leading up to verses 20 through 23. Everything that happens before this is leading up to the verses 20 through 23, and everything after it flows out of verses 20 to 23. At the end of verse 19, it says that Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes sets up kings. He gives wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O you God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might and has made known to me now what we've desired of you, for you have now made known unto us the king's matter. Listen, if you or I were telling this story, we might have rushed directly from that prayer meeting with Daniel and his friends right to the king's throne room, where Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar, this is your dream and this is what it means. Hopefully, verses 20 through 23 will help us to remember not to get in too much of a hurry. When God answers your prayer, do not rush off without thanking him. Don't go from making your pleas to making your plans without making time for praise. It's clear when you look at this prayer that what Daniel's saying is not just some recent observation about God. Verse 21 is actually a pretty good commentary on chapter 1. Right? Verse 21, God determines the times and the seasons, just like he determined in Daniel 1 that it was time for Judah's judgment. God removes kings and sets up kings, just like he did in chapter 1 when he handed Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar. God gives wisdom and understanding, just like he did in chapter 1 when the four Hebrew students are said to be blessed by God, not by their schooling, but by God. When verse 19 says, Daniel blessed the God of heaven, listen, that is an important phrase. That phrase, the God of heaven, is all over this chapter. It's in verse 18 and 19 and 28 and 37 and 44. And it stands as a contrast to those supposed wise men of Babylon. Right? They've already admitted that they have an inability to know what the king has asked. Remember verses 10 and 11, they said, no man on earth can show you these things. Only divine knowledge can reveal it. It can't be known, they said, except to the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh, right? What they're saying is the only answer you could get is from a divine source, and the gods are not here, and they do not talk to us. But Daniel says there is a God in heaven, and he does reveal himself to people. That phrase, God of heaven, it is used by the prophets of the exile far more than it was ever used before. Before this, the phrase God of Israel was most often used. But now, they've been taken into exile, and they're far away from Israel. And yet they can look into the sky and remind themselves that they are no further from God in Babylon than they were back in Jerusalem. The stars, which the wise men try to manipulate and use to tell the future, those are his stars. The sky is his. Everything under the sky is his. That's the point of Daniel chapter 2. Don't get distracted by the statue. You are right now under the gaze of the God of heaven, who Daniel says in this prayer is eternal and thoughtful and unsearchable and knowledgeable and powerful and faithful. Or in the words of the Psalms, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. That's the theme. That's the focus of Daniel chapter 2. This story is not going forward without it. God's wisdom and sovereignty gave the king dreams. God's wisdom and sovereignty put limits on what the wise men of Babylon could do. God's wisdom and sovereignty puts compassion into the executioner's heart for Daniel. God's wisdom and sovereignty gives Daniel composure and courage and confidence to face this crisis. God's wisdom and sovereignty is worthy of Daniel's praise. It's worthy of his friend's praise. It's worthy of Nebuchadnezzar's praise. And it is worthy of our praise this morning. As Daniel drives home that point about God's wisdom and sovereignty, it is then, and only then, that he's going to get to the rest of the story. And he's going to say in verse 24, okay, now take me to the king, and we'll talk about this dream.